You are listening to The New Man, Beyond the Macho Jerk and the New Age Wimp. Your host is men's coach and group facilitator, Trip Lanier. He is joined in the studio by the show's producer, Casey Capshaw.
Are you or someone you know drifting aimlessly without a career you can be proud of? How important is a man's purpose in choosing a career? And what social obstacles might get in the way of your achievements? This week we talk with Marty Nimco. He's a career expert and writer for U.S. News & World Report and Kiplingers.com. Listen as he shares with us his controversial opinions, some of which might surprise you. Today we're talking with Marty Nimco. He's the co-president for the National Organization for Men, a contributing editor on career issues for the U.S. News & World Report, and he's also the author of Cool Careers for Dummies, those famous yellow and black books out there. How are you doing, Marty?
I am very well. How are you?
Beautiful, beautiful. I'm so glad you could speak with us today. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, on the men's issues stuff, which I think is what you wanted to talk about, I become increasingly concerned that in the attempt to try to provide fair treatment for women, we are getting very unfair treatment for men.
Okay.
For example, when minorities have a deficit, you know, let's say in reading achievement or in employment, there are massive billion-dollar government programs, nonprofit programs, and even corporate programs to try to redress the imbalance.
Okay.
But when men have an imbalance, even if it's the ultimate imbalance, they live 6 years shorter than women. Not only do we not see more money spent on men's health research, but the vast majority of gender-specific medical research is done on women. I mean, anytime you walk into a supermarket, you're going to see lots of pink ribbons on hundreds of products where they say they're going to share some of the profits with breast cancer research. And yet many, many, many more men die early of heart attacks. And have you ever seen a ribbon or product promotions to try to stop early heart attack in men? Never.
And so what is it? Are men just not squeaky enough as wheels?
Nope. I think that what has happened is, started in the 60s, when the women's movement started, and they got very influential positions at the colleges and universities. And so anybody attending college in the last 25 years will hear a nonstop drumbeat about how men are oppressive and how women are oppressed. And so there's a tremendous number of very, very guilty male college graduates and radicalized female graduates who have taken on positions in thought control parts of society, the media, the college, become professors themselves. So there is no sympathy whatsoever to men, and yet the media will publish anything that is supportive of women's issues. And so it becomes a vicious cycle. You have more people in control of the media who are very pro-female and in turn anti-male, and then the recipient, the general public, receives an endless drumbeat of messages that say, women good, men bad. And this extends even to sitcoms. I mean, you turn on any sitcom, and you're going to endlessly see a doofus dad or a dumb guy being put in his place by a wise woman. This all, if role models have an effect at all, this starts to have an effect on kids, teenagers, and, of course, the current adult generation.
And would you say that this is less of a war between the sexes and more of just a reintegration of positive male masculine energy in our culture?
No, I think it is a war against men, which we are losing, which we have lost.
Uh-huh.
I really don't think for the coming generation it's going to change. It is now so well entrenched that men are the privileged class. For example, I'm sure you've heard a million times the statistics. Women earn 75 cents on a dollar compared to men. There is no more bogus statistic than that. And even though the colleges and the media are experts analyzing statistics, they choose to accept that one on face value. The fact is, for the same work, women earn more than a dollar for each dollar that men earn. There's a wonderful book called Why Men Earn More by Warren Farrell that documents it with career after career after career. Of course, women earn less on average in total because they work far fewer hours. They are much less likely to seek jobs in the very technical, hard fields, like the sciences and math, they are much less likely to want to uproot their family to go around the country for a promotion. They are much less likely to take onerous jobs like ice fishermen in Alaska or sewer repair person, which pays more. So, of course, women earn less. But it's not because of some cabal of white males who are sitting in a boardroom somewhere deciding to pay women less. It's because women are choosing to have lifestyle benefits rather than to go for the most lucrative careers. And yet the way the media portrays it, you would think that men are these horribly sexist people who are paying women less.
So at the root level, why is this happening?
As I said, it is because starting in the 60s, where there was a tremendous effort to try to help those who have less, that is, women and minorities, that started in the colleges and started in student movements, and those people became educated with that philosophy, without regard to merit. It was women earn less, therefore we're going to do more for women. Women are oppressed. It was almost an article of faith. And so with more and more college students graduating with those beliefs and becoming the next generation of journalists and professors and teachers, the people who mold the minds of us, it has become an article of faith that men are oppressors, women are oppressed, and that is the roots of it.
Gotcha. And so we don't want to promote any more victimhood out there. What can we actually do to counter this?
Well, I really think that, you know, women in general are more bonding types. They do tend to organize and join. There is 10 million women's organizations, women entrepreneur organizations, women engineer organizations. I really think that men need to group together. And, you know, the national organization for men that I've started, I'll be really candid with you, I'm working 80 hours a week. I am an editor at U.S. News, which takes a lot of time. I am a career counselor. I host a radio show on NPR. I am busy doing 10 million things. And while I deeply and profoundly care about the issue of men, I simply don't have time. There is a need for a man or a couple of men who are very bright, talented, and journalist types to be relentlessly bombarding the media with article after article showing how men are being treated unfairly. For example, in divorce, I cannot tell you how many letters I get from depressed, sad, and or angry men who in a divorce proceeding, their wives are very capable, they have master's degrees and they're very smart, but when it comes time for divorce, they suddenly say that they're unemployable and that they really can't find a job that pays more than the child care, so they have to stay home. So this husband who they dump, the husband ends up having to pay child support and alimony for years and years and years just because she decided to dump him in a divorce. It is terribly unfair, and there are no articles written about that, no articles getting published. But I got to be candid with you. I am an editor at U.S. News, and I am a columnist at Kiplinger's Personal Finance. And yet when I try to write about this stuff, they refuse to publish it. I just wrote the lead article right now. If you were to go to Kiplinger.com, you will see that the number one lead article on their homepage is my career trends for 2008. And they accepted every word, virtually every word of what I submitted without any changes except for one thing.
What's that?
The last paragraph in which I discussed men's issues. They completely struck it right out. The censorship on men's issues is total and complete. And that's the problem.
Wow.
And that's why it's hard to undo. Because he or she who controls the media and he or she who controls education controls the minds of the current generation and the next generation. So it's impossible to make a change when there is a total censorship around any issues that might be pro-male.
Understood. I'm wondering, through your research and career and the work that you do, what have you learned about today's man?
I think he's scared. I think he has been emasculated. I think he has been so brainwashed into thinking that he is inferior, that he is some inept, socially inept Neanderthal who is relatively clueless compared to women, that guys have, their self-esteems are in the toilet relative to, I'm a little older than you are,
mm-hmm.
and I saw a generation of guys 20 years ago who were really confident and felt the world was their oyster. Now, when I counsel young men, they're very often insecure. They hide their angst with drugs and alcohol and silly conversations about sex and about cars and about the ball game.
How do you see if we're the product of the generation before us? How is today's young man responsible on his own track, and how much of it is a responsibility of the generation before him?
Well, I think he is in some sense, I know you don't want to play victim, but he is a bad victim of nearly every social force. When he was in elementary school, he saw endless, you know, take your daughter to work day. So the girls were off getting trotted off to the workplace, and the guys were being ignored. When they were taught in the fourth grade about social studies, they were starting to hear about how all these evil men did these bad things to oppress the Native Americans and oppressed women, and finally women succeeded and they became suffragettes. All they got was a message that men were bad. They turned on TV when they came home and they started to see that males were portrayed as idiots and women were portrayed as wonderful. So, you know, we on the one hand say for minorities it's critical we have good role models and we need to provide curriculum that is minority friendly because those things plant seeds in people. Well, we've been planting seeds in males, especially white males, to tell them they are bad. And so in some sense, they are victims of a nonstop assault of their self-esteem. And a curriculum in the old days, there were many of the readings that kids were asked to read, stories and books, were about adventure and about heroism and about monsters, the things that boys like. That has all been excised out of the curriculum. So that boys today are having to read about books about relationships and female heroines. These are not things that are likely to engender excitement in a boy. And boys in general are more active. It's harder for them to sit and read in general, but then if they're forced to read all these anti-male and pro-female readings, it's no surprise that their dropout rate is 2.5 times that of girls. It's no surprise that two-thirds of the college graduates are women. And if only one-third of the college graduates are men, in this society where a college degree is an admission ticket to compete for decent jobs, they are left totally behind the eight ball.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. I'd like to talk about careers. A lot of our listeners are out there and having to make some decisions around career. And how important is a man's individual sense of purpose or meaning in selecting his career today?
Well, it depends on the guy. There are some guys who are going to be motivated no matter what. I mean, Bill Gates could have been told you're going to be a shoeshine boy, and he would have probably been a great shoeshine boy and opened a chain of shoeshine shops. But most guys, most men and most women, are not that intrinsically motivated. They've got to feel a certain sense of excitement about their career, or they're just not going to, they'll become the stereotypical slacker guy. Mm-hmm. But here's the secret. This is unconventional wisdom, and I believe it in my soul. The conventional wisdom you're going to hear in the media is, you need to follow your passion. Well, most people are passionate about the same few things. They're passionate about music. They're passionate about sports. They're passionate about fashion. They're passionate about cars. They're passionate about celebrity. They'd like to be a talk show host. And the reality is, because so many people are excited about few relative things, being an actor, being an artist, so many people are interested in those things, and there's only a certain number of jobs, the pay sucks. True of the environment. Also, today's fastest growing religion is not Islam, it's environmentalism. People are just gaga about the environment and global warming. And so everybody who's graduating college, who, again, in college, they've been radicalized to talk about to believe the environment. We need to stop global warming at all costs. It should be our number one priority. So you have 10 zillion people who have passion around these issues, and there aren't 10 zillion jobs. And so what happens is they end up having to work as a volunteer or for really crappy money, and the bosses feel they can treat you like crap because they know there are 10,000 other people who want your job. So the key, ironically, to finding passion in your job is to actually choose a career that's under the radar, that is not everybody's passion. Because I've been doing this career counseling thing for 20 years, and what I've found is that ultimately, real career passion comes from being an expert at something, from being the go-to guy, even if it's something that is totally not sexy. For example, I'm going to tell you a story about a guy who graduated from Michigan State, and he was sleeping on his mother back in his parents' house, doing nothing, sleeping late, you know, playing video games, doing nothing. Well, his cousin got a job. This guy lived in a suburb of Detroit. Got a job in a dashboard manufacturing plant for, it's Navistar. It's a company that makes tractors.
Okay.
And of course, our friend here, who was hanging out on his parents' sofa, had no interest in tractors, let alone their dashboards. But he was sitting around. He wanted to make some money so he could take girls out. So he ended up applying for a job in this place. And he gets a job on the factory floor. Job was to glue the vinyl to the foam of these dashboards. Mm-hmm. Now, what could be more boring? Nobody's ever had passion about that in the history of the universe. Mm-hmm. But But what happened is, because he's a pretty bright guy, he is a Michigan State graduate, he started to ask questions about other guys on the factory floor. And he started to learn. And then he went and he Googled the, you know, terms like vinyl extrusion and other terms that were related to that industry. And he became suddenly knowledgeable. He became the go-to guy. And he got promoted. And he became the foreman. And guess what? Before long, he became passionate about dashboards. My point, I'm coming to a conclusion here. My point is, it doesn't matter really what the field is. It matters that you get a job where there aren't 10,000 people competing. And then you act as though you were passionate about it. Become the go-to guy. Get to be an expert. And you will find yourself becoming passionate. I think that's the key. And especially for guys for whom work is very central to their identity. Unlike women, who very often their attentions are more, they're focused more on family issues and children and stuff like that. For guys, career and mission is critical. The one piece of advice regarding career that if I want you or my listeners to remember one thing, don't focus so much on finding something that sounds passionate. Find something, become an expert at it, and you will become passionate about it.
Beautiful. That's totally against the grain from what we're used to hearing. So.
Yep.
So let's take a little case scenario here. So we've got a guy in transition. He's definitely, let's say he's run the script. He went to college and he got the job and he kind of did what he was supposed to do, but now he's feeling something deep in his belly. Something's got to change. He leaves his job or he's considering leaving his job. How can he temper his scarcity mindset? You know, I've got to pay the bills or I'll lose my house kind of thing, and avoid taking a bad job versus toughing it out and getting the career that he really wants. Is it possible?
Great question. Yeah, great question. Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're worried about where your next your meal is going to come from, that's going to govern all your decisions. So if you've got a job and you hate it, there are two kinds of people. If you quit and that your fear of being homeless is going to motivate you to really work your butt off to get a great job, fine, then quit. Let that scarcity fear fuel your motivation. But if that's going to likely lead you to paralysis and it's not going to really help you, motivate you, then while you're on the current job, ask yourself, how can I either in my current organization or at another organization find something that's likely to be better? And as I said, it doesn't have to be something that intrinsically sounds cool. If it's a reasonable boss and a reasonably ethical business that you're working in, that you're not doing a brain-dead kind of work, and there's opportunity for learning, and your boss is willing to mentor you, it doesn't matter whether it's toothpicks or working in the music industry. Normally, those things that I just mentioned are more important than being in a cool industry.
It seems like the common denominator here is ambition. How much drive does a man have to kind of rise above? And I'm wondering, is ambition something that can be nurtured, or how do we foster ambition? Because I see a lot of guys just kind of waiting around.
That's the most important question of all.
Okay.
As I said earlier, I believe that there are some people who are just intrinsically motivated. The Bill Gateses of the world, and I'm going to be honest, the Marty Nemcos of the world, are just intrinsically motivated. If somebody made me be a garbage collector, I would develop cool new ways to collect garbage. I would have little ways to sell some of the garbage I was collecting to side businesses. I'm driven, right? And so some of it is genetic. It's just, you know, you talk to any mother who's had two babies, and she will admit to you immediately that the baby came out of the womb with a distinctly different personality. Some are really high energy and really focused. Others are space cadets. That's just the way it is. We are at least half genetic, but we're not all genetic. We're part of genetic. So for the people who are not intrinsically motivated, it's usually a combination of things that helps them get motivated. Number one, yeah, something that they're intrinsically more interested in will certainly motivate them more. Two, having somebody they're accountable to. I call it a loving taskmaster. If you're not intrinsically motivated, you may be motivated by embarrassment. You don't want your coach, your mentor, and it doesn't have to be a paid coach. It could be your friend. It could be your girlfriend. It could be your mother. Where you're checking in every day on making a report on what you accomplished, having a specific set of goals. So a lot of people who are not that motivated need structure. So you hate your job. You're in a boring job where you're doing the same old crappy thing all the time. You can't stand it. Mm-hmm. But you're afraid of scarcity to quit. You say, okay, every day I am going to make cold contacts to five people who might potentially hire me for something better. And you just chart that every day, and you report into your loving taskmaster every day. You give yourself a concrete goal. What also helps is picturing the benefit. Let's say you're somebody, I'm just being real straight here, a lot of guys, they really want to get laid. That's their big thing, mm-hmm. and they're single. And unfortunately, women, you know, a lot of women really like guys with money. And so it sometimes takes money to get laid. And so if that's your goal, if you want to have money to be able to go out with a lot of women and take them out to not cheap play, which I think, by the way, is foolish. It's then you're getting the wrong women, women who want you for your money, not you. But if that happens to motivate you, keeping a picture of some beautiful women in front of you as an ongoing reminder that this is why you need to make those five calls to five employers. Those are some of the things that can boost motivation.
One thing I heard that was in there that I felt was really critical was sharing your goal with somebody, like being accountable to somebody.
Yeah.
Some guy can be isolated and he's therefore no one knows and then he doesn't have anything to lose, right?
Yeah, but it depends on the guy. I mean, I am the last guy in the world who would ever join a support group or be accountable to a person. It's not me. Mm-hmm. If I were to do that at all, I would go, you know, have these online trackers where you can, you know, these goal trackers where you check in on the website every day and you chart your progress and all that. If I were to do it, I would do that. I would do that. But it really, one size doesn't fit all. Some guys do really well in support groups. Women love support groups. Some guys, a fewer number of guys do. So yeah, support group. Or it could be your mother or your father. Or it could be an online thing, or you simply put a little chart on graph paper on the side of your desk, or you use a little pro. There are all these free like weight loss trackers. There's no reason you can't use it for. Doesn't have to be for weight. You can use it for anything you're trying to do. If you're trying to make X number of calls today, you can use one of those weight loss trackers instead of tracking your weight. You can track the number of calls you made. Sometimes seeing the accomplishments work. It really varies with the individual. It's, you know, it's like I've got this toolkit, and there's a bunch of tools that might be useful, but no one will work for everybody.
Got
one
it.
Size does not fit all.
Got it. I'm wondering, you've been in the position to see all kinds of different careers and see lots of different people in different positions, and I'm wondering if the grass is really greener on the other side. I mean, are you finding that people who are living their purpose through their career, you know, doing the ideal thing, are they any happier?
Well, you know, I really think it's not the career, it's who you are. I mean, look at Lindsay Lohan, look at Britney Spears, look at Anna Nicole Smith, look at Nicole Richie. All of them had the dream careers, and all of them in their lives are totally screwed up. Basically, you are who you are. I've seen happy dishwashers, and I've seen miserable rock stars. I happen to know really well one of the best paid radio talk show hosts in America. He makes $1 million a year. He's a friend of mine. He's a miserable son of a bitch. Really unhappy. That's who he is. He says, oh man, if I get this better contract, I'll do better than it. It has nothing to do with that. He's a miserable son of a bitch. You know, I'm not a Christian. I'm an atheist. But, you know, the Christian notion of gratitude is a good one.
Mm.
People who are grateful for you're in Colorado, right? You know, the Rocky Mountains or the fresh air or getting laid or going out to eat or being able to be productive and not lying in pain with stage 4 cancer is a cool way to go through life. Looking at that glass as half full is really important. And yes, I really do believe that productive work matters a lot, but it doesn't matter what it is. Even if you're a dishwasher, you can be happy if you realize that making those dishes clean and sanitary and keep making it not look, making the plates look pleasant for people and not dirty is a worthy enterprise. Everything is a worthy enterprise except maybe tobacco sales.
I get that point. It also flies in the face because as men, we're totally, I'd say by and large, totally identified with what we do. Oh, hey,
right.
I'm Joe Blow. I'm an attorney. It's like, I don't really, well, are you happy? Or are you, you know, how's your life going? It's nothing that we're identified by what we do in the world. And this flies in the face of that.
A little bit. I want you to be identified with what you do. So I want you to be identified with your career. But I encourage you to go under the road less traveled, go under the radar to careers that people don't normally think about. Let me tell you a story about a guy. I was driving down Auto Row in Napa, California, and there's this little stucco building, the plainest building you ever saw in your life, and it says Napa Valley Transmission. Right? Well, I hadn't even thought about it, but I'd noticed it as I was driving along. And my wife is the superintendent of schools in Napa County, and we were invited to this big Democratic fundraiser. And so, it was in this very, very rich area above Silverado Country Club, this really fancy area. So we're driving up through the hills, and the houses are getting nicer and nicer and nicer. We finally get to the top, and this is where this fundraiser is. And we go into this enormous meadow, perfectly manicured, that leads out to a gorgeous Georgian home with pillars and everything. And this is where the fundraiser is being held. And I asked, who owns it? The owner of that little Napa Valley transmission shop, that little hole in the wall that's down on Auto Row. And I met him, and he loves his life because there's no he's a reasonably bright guy, not a genius. But there's no competition in a field like that, because the people who tend to go into that field, especially now where the message is always, unless you go to college, you're going to be a third-class citizen. He's competing with total idiots, and he's able to make millions of dollars with a simple, low-status business. And he loves his life because he is the go-to guy, and he can make a lot of money without being unethical, and he can work reasonable hours. But the thing that he did do was recognize status is the enemy of contentment. So I do want your work life to be a key part of your identity, but I encourage you to avoid the status professions unless you're a real superstar. If you're a superstar, fine. But even some of those superstars who work for corporate law firms, a lot of them are unhappy.
Yeah.
Recent studies show that 44% of corporate lawyers, and they're making big bucks, would not recommend that to their kids as a career.
I love your Day in the Life articles. I was checking out your website earlier, and I was wondering, do you see a common theme?
Well, among the 31 careers that I chose, perhaps the most important common denominator is whether you were going to succeed frequently or not. There are certain careers where you fail a lot, for example, oncologist, unfortunately, but optometrist and audiologist and hairstylist and biomedical equipment repair person and locksmith. These are careers in which you are clearly helping people, but you succeed a high percentage of the time, and you're seeing successes often. It's not like if you're working in a job where you're this manager of a corporation, you could go a whole year without a win. Where each of these that I just mentioned, with every patient who walks out of your optometry office, you've pleased them, or almost all of them. If you're a hairstylist, every customer is normally, you know, unless you screw up a haircut, generally is happy with what you've done. Every locksmith, if somebody's been locked out of their car and you're the locksmith that comes to let them in, they're thrilled with you.
You're the hero.
That's critical to the quality of life.
Beautiful. I love that. Did you have a favorite one that that you kind of like made you think twice about what you're doing?
I've got a four-ring circus career. I spend my life doing the following. I'm a radio talk show host on NPR. I'm a columnist at Kipling's Personal Finance. I am an editor at U.S. News and World Report. I have a very, very oversubscribed, busy career counseling practice. I breed roses. I play the piano. I'm an actor and director. I mean, I've got the greatest life. Why would I want to change anything?
Beautiful. So what's the biggest misconception out there? What's the most overrated job that you see people getting in line for?
Doctor and lawyer.
Doctors and lawyers.
Yeah, you've got a major in this horrible, yucky field. You're not necessarily a major, but you've got to take all these hard science and math courses undergraduate and get great grades, killing yourself to do it. Then you go to medical school and you're working day and night, paying $200,000. Then you get to have to be an intern and your 100-hour work week. Then you got a 2 to 4 year residency. Then first you get hired and you're sued for malpractice a lot. Should be insurance companies are telling you you can only see patients for 12 minutes. They're only reimbursing you for small amounts of money. The patients are coming in with waving internet printouts telling you that they know more than you do. You know, the doctor is no longer the god. So, you know, the most overrated career, doctor.
It's a fucking drag.
To hear more from Marty Nemko, check out his free articles and radio programs at martynemko.com.